Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of whiz, if ever a whiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a whiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series. But with a twist, my name is Smithy and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This is part 9 of the Wizards of Money series and it is entitled Jack and the Sweatshop. In this, the 9th edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at the manager of the 20th century, Jack Welch, General Electric CEO for the 20 years up until fall of 2001. In September 2001, Jack's much-awaited autobiography entitled Jack Straight from the Gut was released with much fanfare. Business professionals are besides themselves with praise for the book. For example, Warren Buffett's comments are that, quote, all CEOs want to emulate him, end quote. The chairman of Sony Corporation stated, quote, Jack Welch, the brilliant business magician, has finally disclosed his mysteries of management, end quote. Since Jack is a brilliant business magician, and since during his watch he transformed GE's small credit company into GE Capital, the largest non-bank financial institution in the world, and almost half of the modern GE, he is definitely one of the most important wizards of the 20th century. In the midst of the gushing reviews of Jack's book, his career and management style, it is important to analyze his influence on corporate culture in America. From his ability in the 1980s to turn mass firings of employees from an attack on communities into an almost saintly act of saving companies from inefficiency, to the 1990s trend of establishing high-tech sweatshops overseas, Jack has built a new model of the American corporation. In this new model, the only US employees are managers. These managers get churned out at the so-called People Factory in Crotonville, New York, also known as Jack's Cathedral, and they manage the overseas units where the real work is done at optimal cost. The other key part of the US operation is the Capital Factory, GE Capital, the company's own mini Wall Street. With most real production done outside of the corporation, what does GE actually produce? What is the measure by which GE is acclaimed to be the great success of the 20th century? Is it great light bulbs, great engines, great electricity, or is it something else? It's earnings. GE is the best manufacturer of earnings in the 20th century. It has the sexiest looking balance sheet and income statement bookkeeping entries of all. Recall that we spoke extensively about the earnings manufacturing business in Wizards Part 8. You can get all past editions of the Wizards of Money at www.wizardsofmoney.org. In this edition of Wizards, as we look at the cathedral that Jack built, we will be hearing some excerpts of an interview Jack did with Bob Joss at a Commonwealth Club event on November 12, 2001, with an audience of Stanford business students. At the other end of the spectrum, we will be hearing an interview I did on January 5, 2002 with Jessica Lindberg, housewife and mother in Rome, Georgia, on the banks of the PCB-laden Coosa River in North Georgia. She has been busy trying to get GE to clean up its mess in this North Georgia town, and she even confronted Jack at his final GE shareholder meeting as chairman about this issue. To get this episode underway and to give a brief overview of Jack's career and what it was all about, I found a fictional story, I'm not sure where it came from, that has some similarities with Jack Welch's story. The main character is also Jack, and a quick telling of this fictional story should help you get a handle on Mr. Welch's saga in a quick and easy to understand way. The fictional story is called Jack and the Corporate Ladder. This is the story called Jack and the Corporate Ladder. Some people call it Jack the Giant Killer. Once upon a time, there was a young man named Jack. He lived with his father and mother in Massachusetts, and they were a family of humble means. Jack's father was a railway conductor and was always very busy trying to earn a living for his family. So Jack spent a lot of time with his mother, whom he adored and who adored him. One day Jack left his dear mother and set off for the markets to find a job. He found one in the land of GE. After some years of hard work, some GE merchants offered Jack a trade that he didn't like, the same bonus level as his colleagues, and so he decided to quit. But then a more crafty merchant offered Jack a handful of better treats, a larger bonus, and some special treatment in return for Jack's future loyalty. Jack thought this was a pretty good deal, and so he went home, banked his bonus, and nurtured his ambition. The next day, he went back to work and saw a huge corporate ladder in sight. An ambitious fellow, Jack began the long climb to the top. Jack had heard that there were giants at the top of the corporate ladder, and that he might have to fight them when he got there. Well, he considered it all a big game, and he really wanted to win the game. He was really determined to deal with those giants when he got to the top. Along the way up the corporate ladder, Jack bumped into a giantish-looking fellow called Ronnie. Jack and Ronnie made good friends, and both were determined to kill the giants when they got to the top. For the giants interfered with freedom, they both agreed on that. However, about a quarter of the way up the top, Ronnie was thrown off the corporate ladder. The land of GE had important contracts with the giants, and Ronnie's constant chatter of giant killing was messing with these deals. Ronnie was determined to get to the top another way, so he started to set his sights on becoming the main giant at the top himself. Meanwhile, Jack continued his journey to the top of the corporate ladder. Finally, Jack got to the top, and there he could see huge amounts of riches and treasures in this new land that he considered rightfully his. But there were some battles to be fought and won in order to claim those riches for himself. Well, first there was the issue of giants. Not long after he arrived, Jack bumped into the leading giant of the land, only to find out that it was his friend Ronnie, who had also just made it to the land of the top. Jack couldn't be more pleased at this. Together, Jack and Ronnie vowed to rid the land of the rest of the giants so that the riches could be theirs. Only, there were a few other things in the way. Standing between them and the riches were thousands of annoying little creatures that were also trying to get a bit of the riches for themselves. These annoying critters were called jobs, and Jack immediately set to killing the ones he really didn't like and banishing the rest to lands far, far away. Subsequent to that, Jack thought he better set up a people factory so he could churn out people to behave exactly how he wanted them to. Jack used the people factory to build something of an army to help him get across to the riches and wipe out any other unexpected obstacles along the way. More trouble arose when Jack and his army got to the land of the media, where nasty stories were spreading about Jack the job killer, and they even called him Neutron Jack for his ability to kill jobs and leave buildings standing. This really upset Jack. He was only trying to get what was rightfully his. He put a stop to all this by invading the land of the media and taking over a good chunk of it for himself. Over the next few years, Jack and his army collected a huge amount of the riches for themselves. But then they came to the big river crossing, where they met a hostile giant who wanted to take a bunch of their riches. Ronnie was no longer around to help them with this giant. Jack and his army fought a long, hard, nasty battle for more than 20 years, but they finally lost and had to concede some riches to the giant. Never mind, Jack and his army just went and found other riches they could take. Jack was getting pretty old by this time and thinking about retiring from the big game when he came across yet another hostile giant. This one was from a land far, far away, and approached Jack, saying, "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the makings of a vertical monopoly." This new giant seemed to exhaust Jack, and he retired from his life of giant killing with all the riches he had accumulated along the way. That's the end of the story called Jack and the Corporate Ladder. Now back to the real Jack Welch. How does his mind work? How does he justify mass layoffs, the pressuring of contractors to lay off workers and move factories to Mexico, the stingy wages in the high-tech sweatshops in India, and the constant denial that EPA-rated probable carcinogens are perfectly safe? Well, we'll let Jack explain this in his own words. Here is an excerpt from the November 12, 2001 Commonwealth Club interview with Jack Welch.
One of the things that I get challenged on a lot is winning. Somehow or other, people think winning is bad. It's all about winning. Business is a game. Business is a game where you field the best team, and the team that fields the best players wins the game. And what do? They pay taxes, they celebrate, employees give back to the community, the company gives back to the community, they're good citizens. All these things happen. What happens when a company misses and loses? No one's popping champagne in the dugouts. No, everyone has got job insecurities. All these things occur, and yet people say, winning is such a crass thing. Winning is what it's about. That's when you can give back. That's when you become a valued member of society. I used to run the United Ways in the New York area, and you'd go in the tri-state area calling on companies in a recession. I remember going in 82. And you'd show up at the door, the guy said, "Jesus, I'm sorry, I can't help you this year. Things are really tough." And that happens over and over again. So my challenge to all of you is, don't be embarrassed by winning. Love winning. Create excitement around winning.
It appears that in his own mind, Jack is unable to separate what he does from a baseball game or a good golf game. Under his logic, the team can only do good if it beats everybody else. The scorecard is the earnings report, the abstract has become the real, and the real has become completely abstract. Of course, Jack doesn't know what it feels like to be on the receiving end of his big game, big business decisions. He doesn't know what it's like to be laid off, to work in an overseas sweatshop, or to live in a toxic wasteland that nobody wants to clean up. This other side is perhaps the losing team in Jack's mind. Certainly, the losing team in Jack's game doesn't see this business as a game. Jack never mentions in his book, nor in his interview, the rather large handicap he is given by the American taxpayer in this game of business. Tax breaks, subsidies, accounting wizardry, media ownership, and your very own mini Wall Street created through years of favored access to credit can all help tremendously. To link this episode with Wizards Part 8, let's take a look at the aftermath of the Enron collapse as an example of gifts to GE provided by the taxpayer. In Wizards Part 8, we touch briefly on Enron's power operations in India. Partners of Enron in this operation were none other than GE Capital and the Bechtel Corporation. Why them, you might ask? Well, for many years, GE has taken advantage of the opportunities for high-tech sweatshops in India. India has millions of well-educated, technically trained, English-speaking people that cost mere peanuts compared to US workers. Consequently, GE has now exported all kinds of technical operations to India, from data entry to accounting to customer service to loans and claims processing and, of course, computer programming. But for years, Jack was frustrated. He had the cheap bodies in India, but he didn't have the electricity to power the high-tech sweatshops. Similarly, Bechtel Corporation moved engineering operations to India, and the engineers needed electricity too. On Jack's September 2000 visit to India, he is quoted by the Telegraph as saying, quote, "When you think of digitizing India, there will be a massive amount of power required, and I pray to this government that you have to push and push and push to invest in infrastructure," end quote. The Enron GE Bechtel venture into Indian electricity production seemed to start off promising enough. But in 2001, the main purchaser of this electricity, the Maharashtra state government, stopped paying its bills, partly contributing to Enron's problems. Then, with all its other problems, Enron finally collapsed, and things looked grim for the three patrons of high-tech sweatshop electricity. Crying over their losses, they all went to the US government last month to ask for almost $250 million compensation from the US taxpayer. Yes, this is really true. Fact is stranger than fiction. A December 20th, 2001, Dow Jones Newswire article that went almost completely unnoticed reported that three US giants had made a claim to the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, an agency of the US government, for $200 million in what is known as expropriation compensation. Well, that's globalization for you. The star of our show today is, of course, the king of globalization. So, on this topic, let's see what Jack Welch himself has to say about globalization. At the November 12th Commonwealth Club event, people were allowed to ask some questions. No, not the questions they really wanted to ask, don't be silly. When it comes to questions to business gurus in the free world these days, the methodology runs as follows. You submit your questions on paper in advance, and then a committee decides which are the appropriate questions, and then they get reworded to optimize their appropriateness. This seemed to be going on in most corporations, and also, of course, for government gurus. And so it was with questions at this Commonwealth Club event, even though it was a very safe audience. It was Stanford business students, mostly. But then Jack had probably thought that the audience at the annual shareholders meeting in Atlanta earlier that year was probably safe too, but a real question did slip through the cracks. We'll hear more about this later. Anyway, the following question on globalization versus democracy, posed to Jack at the Commonwealth Club event, was probably the closest that one came to a real question. Please listen carefully to Jack's response.
Here's a really big picture question, Jack. How do you reconcile the conflict, assuming you see a conflict, between democracy and the corporate culture of globalization?
Oh, I think that's pretty easy. I happen to believe globalization is a great thing. I happen to believe that globalization is the best chance in the world for the have-nots to become haves. I'll give you a country that I'm more familiar with, being a thick Irishman. Take Ireland. Look at Ireland 20 years ago. It had nothing. American businesses came there. Businesses came from the continent. Today, Ireland is thriving. Great GDP growth, great income per capita. Ireland's now wondering, hey, Jack, what do we do? Gateway just announced that they're moving a big factory to India. I said, welcome to globalization. You're moving up the food chain. You've got to invest more in technology. You've got to invest more in knowledge. You've got to reinvest in that. Now, globalization has not solved all the world's problems. It has not cured cancer. It has clearly not reached parts of the subcontinent. It didn't reach Afghanistan. It didn't reach another. I understand some of the critics' views of globalization, but only one. That's the labor unions in developed countries. They run the threat of losing jobs, low value-added jobs. They have a basic argument. I don't understand the environmentalist view of it, because every place you go, you bring world-class standards, and you put factories in that are better than anything in the country, and people bring, and the neighborhood gets better. So I don't understand that argument. That argument falls on deaf ears with me, because every U.S. company that goes to a country brings world-class environmental standards. Now, it hasn't cured everything, though. And we need it needs to get broader. It needs to get better. But it shouldn't be the whipping man or woman for war, for other things. It has given more to the have-nots than anything yet invented. Anything yet invented. If you remember something better, it's done better than the UN has, it's done better than a zillion organizations have, in improving the lives of millions of people. Go to Prague, go to Budapest, go to East Berlin, go see these things. People are living far better than they ever dreamt, and because of globalization. Not that I care about the subject.
Let us take a good look at this issue of exporting world-class environmental standards and a little bit of a look at job exporting. We will now listen to an interview I did on January 5th this year with Jessica Lindberg, mother of two in the town of Rome, Georgia, who founded a group there called Citizens Action Network. Rome is in the northwest corner of Georgia, between Atlanta, Georgia and Chattanooga, Tennessee. It is also not far from a town called Anniston in Alabama that has received a lot of national attention lately. For about 40 years, GE operated a medium transformer manufacturing plant in Rome, Georgia. For about half of those years, it dumped its waste products into several landfills and waterways of Rome. After NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement, came into effect in 1994, GE didn't waste any time. They promptly moved operations to Mexico and left their PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, and their dioxins, the killer chemical in Agent Orange, and many other chemical cocktails behind. In contrast to Anniston, Alabama, in contrast to the Hudson River in New York and the situation in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, the Rome, Georgia toxicity problems get scant media attention, both in the mainstream and in the independent media. Yet, this story is so important. In the following interview, note that the EPD is the Environmental Protection Division, an environmental enforcement agency of the Georgia State Government. I started the interview by asking Jessica Lindberg how she came to form the Rome, Georgia-based Citizens Action Network.
I got involved in September of 2000 after an article in the Rome News Tribune talking about the presence of PCBs and other potential toxins in the creek close to my house. And I have two young children, and I was concerned about their safety. So I got involved with another professor, a professor at Floyd College. And we started to talk about what we could do, and our first priority was to see how many other people knew about this and were concerned enough to try to do something to speed up the cleanup process. And that's how we formed Citizens Action Network.
And can you talk about whereabouts the GE site is, what was actually done at the factory, and how you first found out about the PCBs, especially in relation to where your kids go to school and where they play?
I didn't know very much about PCBs. In fact, I'd never heard the term before the article in the Rome News Tribune. So I had a lot of self-education to do on that. But of course, as any mother, when you read in the paper that there may be a potential cancer-causing agent in the park where your children are playing, you're going to do everything you possibly can to get rid of it and to find out about it. It didn't matter to me that it was potential cancer-causing. It was just that it was there in the first place, mm-hmm. and it needed to be gone, and I didn't understand why they couldn't just come scoop it out and make it go away. At the plant, which is, I'm not very good at distances, a couple of miles from my house, to the west, they had several runoff creeks and tributaries, one of which was Little Dry Creek, which runs through the park that's close to my house. And from 1952 to 1977 or 76, they manufactured medium transformers at that plant using Pyrenol, as the which contained the PCBs, mm-hmm. As the liquid in the transformers. And a lot of that was a lot of that waste and runoff went directly into storm drains and runoff and tributaries from the property. So a lot of it got out into the community that way. The other way it got out into the community was that GE gave it away to employees and friends of employees in 50-gallon drums, mm-hmm. To take home and use as termite treatment for their houses, or painted on fence posts for getting rid of termites, or spreading on dusty roads to keep the dust down, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. There's also an issue, I think it's unique to Rome, where the PCBs have actually entered the groundwater, which I don't know. I don't believe that's an issue with the Hudson River case or the Pittsfield, Massachusetts case. Can you talk about what's going on there? How have the PCBs entered the groundwater? And also, the other places where the PCBs are, such as in the soil, throughout the soil, how did it get there?
I can talk more about the soil than I can about the groundwater. Mm. The soil was from the homeowners taking it home,
okay,
and using it on their houses. The homeowners at the time, the people who took it home, had no reason to believe that there was anything wrong with it.
Back to the groundwater issue, I know you said you didn't know much about it, but you actually gave a good description before of how the groundwater enters, once it seeps into the soil, how the groundwater goes into, say, underground aquifers. It's very different to what GE's faced in the northern states. And can you talk about in the northwest corner of Georgia, when water enters the soil, how does it sort of seep into the ground?
Well, it's mostly limestone, mm-hmm. and it's karst topography, which means that limestone dissolves and there's all these little holes everywhere, and there could be great pools of water, standing groundwater, in different areas,
mm-hmm.
And along with that, the chemicals that we don't want there, and it's extremely hard to track.
So
where it all
be
is
anywhere,
and where it's going,
and
right.
You don't know
right.
where it is,
right?
Which
right.
is very different to the Hudson, where they're pretty sure that it's, mm-hmm. it's confined to that area around the river,
right? Right. GE continues to say that kind of topography does not exist on this site, and mm-hmm. that's another question that's up for debate.
So that would make it unique to the rest of northwest Georgia,
right?
Would it? Okay. It seems to me that the issue in Rome is not just PCBs, but a number of other chemicals that were coming off the site, including dioxins, which is a known carcinogen, at least if it's not formally known as one, it's informally known as one.
Mm-hmm.
Furans, is that
furans,
what?
Furans.
Furans,
yeah.
Chlorinated benzenes and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Has GE admitted that those things are an issue, and what is going on with respect to
I have never heard them admit that that is an issue. What I've heard them say over and over again is that dioxins are a byproduct of PCBs burning at high temperatures. And what I've heard them say over and over again is that they never got hot enough to create dioxins.
Okay.
And I've heard them say these dioxins are coming from other places, perhaps the carpet mills or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard them directly say these were responsible for these dioxins. I know that dioxins have been found in several places off-site, but I don't know what's happened since then.
Mm-hmm.
With that.
Yeah, it's my understanding from looking through some of the documents, there was a public comment period on one of the permit changes,
mm-hmm.
and looking at some of the documents coming out of that, that the EP, the Georgia Environmental Protection Division, now has information that dioxins are an issue in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps in contrast to what DE's been saying about dioxins, and that they are now mandated to test for mm-hmm. dioxins, furans, mm-hmm. chlorinated benzenes, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. But there has also been some testing for dioxins done by the EPA.
Right.
And I think that they were the first ones to find them. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Or that it was testing that the EPA said the EPD had to do.
One of the reasons that I started looking into this issue, I spent a lot of time in North Georgia. I meet a lot of people from Rome, and I was stunned to find out how many people I kept meeting from Rome who had some kind of serious cancer problem in their immediate family. Can you talk about the sort of the funny things that are going on in Rome in certain areas near the site and the stories that are coming out about cancer and other health problems?
The stories I've heard over and over again are various forms of cancer, mostly pancreatic cancer. Lots of brain tumors or mysterious brain illnesses that sound to me like when they're described as nervous disorders or functions of the nervous system collapsing. The other really disturbing thing for me as a mother that I've heard over and over again are the high instances of miscarriages or children born with birth defects
mm-hmm.
or stillborns. And children dying, which, you know, is always upsetting.
Really?
But there's this one little pocket neighborhood that we walked through across from the GE plant and just heard. We walked through the neighborhood with one of the people who lives there, and every house we walked by, he pointed to and listed some horrible, tragic illness or something that had happened in that family. And he said he was filled with remorse that I think that he never did anything about it and that he was so trusting. But he said that that road, every time it rained, would back up and the drains come from underneath the street. The culvert comes from underneath the street from the GE property straight onto this road, and the storm water runoff on the other side of the road would back up and the children would all play in it.
Oh, really?
So, you know, that's the sort of funny thing that we heard over and over again that you can't confirm in any sort of study that we could fund.
Can you talk about what GE is actually doing, both about the Coosa River and the sites, which, just back to the groundwater issue, the groundwater issue is coming from one of the landfills where a lot of the dumping of the, mm-hmm. the waste products were. What is GE doing to fix it up, and do people feel that that's enough?
I don't think anybody feels like it's enough, simply because it's been 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working on groundwater, and we're working on landfills. We haven't even gotten to the building. So the fact that it's gone on for so long and we're just still where we are
mm-hmm.
Is very indicative of the way this company works. It's the way they've done it in the Hudson, to fight every step of the way.
Right.
They have done some good and quick things in the community that have helped their public relations here immensely. I can't say whether or not that's why they did them so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Things like when they found residents at high levels, when the residents would allow it, they cleaned it up immediately. They cleaned up the schools. They cleaned up West Central. I think there were some found at West End, too.
That's,
they cleaned up Tolbert Park. They cleaned up Tolbert Park more, actually, than the EPD required of them. The EPD had issued a letter saying it was clean, and they went back and did grid sampling and cleaned
mm-hmm.
it up even further. That was the one. Tolbert Park is where I live, and West Central is where my kids go to school, and that's where my focus was. And as a result of that, that's where the group's focus was.
But is the issue with the contaminated sites that nobody really knows how much contamination there is? That it's good and well to have examined these sites immediately neighboring the GE property, but now that they've cleaned up those particular sites, is the issue that there's still a lot of PCBs out there and all these other chemicals, and you just don't know where they are?
That has been our issue all along,
mm-hmm.
is that I've never understood why a company wouldn't say, oh my gosh, we release these things and they're harmful. Let's clean up everything within 25-mile radius. Let's do a grid sampling on the whole city or the whole county. And, of course, they're not going to do that because that's not Jack Welch's GE.
On the issue of Jack Welch, since he's the focus of the Wizards of Money episode, you actually had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Welch at the last shareholders meeting that was held in Atlanta in April of 2001. And can you describe, first of all, who you went? I'm assuming that you're not a GE shareholder.
No, I'm not a GE shareholder.
Okay, but you got to go to the shareholders meeting. So can you describe how you got to go to the shareholders meeting and what happened when you got there?
I was invited to speak at a press conference before the shareholders meeting across the street from it by a shareholder group who's concerned about the Hudson. They had brought an issue forward as shareholders. They wanted GE to disclose publicly how much in advertising dollars they had spent to fight the dredging of the Hudson. And I gave my story at the press conference before the meeting. And they were all on their way over to the meeting, and they were impressed with what I had to say in my story. They also wanted to bring some relevance to Georgia since the meeting was being held in Georgia. So they invited me to come with them as a guest, which I was very flattered and immediately agreed to do with some trepidation, knowing that I would be walking into the lion's den. And they put the little badge on me, and we started walking into the room, bypassing all of the people that I had been dealing with in Rome, Betsy Weltner, the public relations person, Gary Sheffer, all of them, their eyes getting bigger and bigger. What are you doing here? The meeting began, and when their issue came forward, one of the nuns kind of nudged me and said, okay, go talk at the microphone. And I stood up and went to one of the two microphones in this room full of thousands of people at the Atlanta Civic Center. And brought my question forward, which was along the lines of, I'm Jessica Lindberg, I'm a housewife in Rome, Georgia, and where you had a plant, and is Rome facing the same 25-year battle that has been fought in the Hudson to get our community cleaned up? And there was silence and then immediate applause from the audience, which was overwhelming and very affirming for me that other people could see that this issue as simply.
Was there applause from Jack Welch as well?
There was not applause from Jack Welch, but he did look up and acknowledge me, which is a big step because he didn't do that with a lot of people, and said that he was very concerned, that GE was very concerned about Rome and that they were doing everything they could.
And when he spoke about what GE was doing in Rome, was his statistics accurate?
No, not entirely, no.
Okay.
But, of course, there's no way to get. In fact, one of the things he said was that GE had spent $25 million in the Rome community cleaning up PCBs, and that didn't sound right to me. And I asked Richard Lester, who's the plant manager at GE, when we got home the next week, to give me those numbers, if he could provide any sort of information on how much they'd spent. And he said, of course, that they couldn't, that was confidential.
They could not tell you how much they'd spent.
Right.
I found it interesting that the only Atlanta news outlet that covers this, that covered this issue to any extent and that wanted to interview you, was the 11 Alive news TV news, which is an NBC station, and NBC obviously is owned by GE. Do you find that at all peculiar that it's only the NBC station that wanted to cover this issue?
I did it first, and then after extensive talking to the reporter who did the coverage and also my father, who's in the media business as well, I didn't have any worries about it at all. I didn't think they were related. I don't think that anybody at GE pays any attention to what they're doing at this small, local level, except for after the fact. She didn't seem to give it two thoughts.
Okay.
But also, Creative Loafing did do a story on her.
The story to hit the national press recently was the Washington Post article on Monsanto. The interesting thing in that article was the discussion of when Monsanto knew that PCBs were a probable carcinogen and they cause all kinds of environmental damage. And it seems that they had a committee, Monsanto itself had a committee that was set up in 69 that actually recommended Monsanto phase out the use of PCBs at that point. But interestingly, they found some Monsanto documents that said that GE pressured Monsanto to keep producing PCBs because they needed it in their own business. And also the article mentions that Monsanto was sending all of its customers, including GE, warnings about the use of PCBs, and this was going back to the 60s. You talked about how employees brought Pyrenol home. Was this, do you know, was this during the 60s and 70s as well as before that?
I believe it was, because okay. The plant didn't open until 53.
Okay.
So I believe that they were still taking the Pyrenol home during the 60s. I don't know how far into the 70s.
Okay.
I think it was up until 77, until...
Until they stopped using
right,
PCBs.
Right.
What happened to the plant? Is it still in operation?
Not as a transformer plant, no. Mostly as offices, I think. They have about...
Why don't they just close it down?
What I've heard is that if they closed it down, the EPD would immediately require everything be cleaned up. And that's why, if, as long as they keep it open and keep a few people working there, they can clean it up on their timetable rather than EPD's timetable.
Okay. Well, what happened to the jobs? I mean, does GE, as I understand it, still produces transformers? Did they set up another factory somewhere else?
In Mexico.
Okay. When did they move them? When did they move all the transformer production to Mexico? Do you remember?
I think it was 94, 95.
Okay, so like right that. After NAFTA
right.
came in. So
right.
they didn't waste
right.
any time.
No.
Okay.
No.
The Georgia Environmental Protection Division is part of Georgia state government. How have they behaved throughout this? I've seen in some of the public comments that people have been saying that they've been quite eager to please GE. Is that generally how they've acted? Or
I don't think that's a fair characterization of the people who work there, but I do think it's a fair characterization of the way our system works.
Right.
The people that we worked with on a day basis to get this cleaned up are just outraged and frustrated by how long it's taking and how little they can do, but they just don't have any money and very few resources and people that they need to be able to clean it up the way they want to.
It's interesting, because I know what it's like to work on issues where you have to deal with the Georgia state government, especially on environmental issues, and to a large extent it's got a lot of the characteristics of the old boys network, and that's a feature of the South. I think it's very interesting that a very influential person in Georgia, ex-Senator Sam Nunn, who was a senator for many years in Georgia, is also on the board of GE and has been on the board since 1994. Do you have any feel for whether that's been an influence on how the state's reacted to this particular problem?
I don't know. That would be pure speculation.
Okay.
I don't know how it could have been, except for the old boy.
You haven't seen any evidence of it?
No, we've not heard his name anywhere.
Okay.
Anytime. There was a story about a lawyer who was working both sides of the case, who had Harold Rehise's, who's the director of the EPA, EPD, Harold Rehise's ear on the water talks, but she was also a GE lawyer on this issue.
She was working for the EPA and for GE?
EPD and GE.
Okay.
Yes, I think...
On the issue of Sam, and I know, again, this is pure speculation, but he is a senior partner at King & Spalding, and now King & Spalding has been Monsanto's lawyer representing them on a lot of these chemical issues, and so I find it interesting that, you know, he's also on the board of GE, which has similar chemical problems. In the case of the Hudson, the EPA stepped in, the federal body stepped in and demanded the dredging. Why hasn't the EPA stepped in on this issue? What's the mechanism of how that works, do you know?
For as long as possible, the EPA will allow the state to handle it. Mm-hmm. For as long as the state is getting cooperation from GE and GE is fulfilling the state requirements, the EPA must stay out of it.
Okay.
They cannot get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And GE has been very careful about just doing what the state mandates.
That was part of the interview I did with Jessica Lindbergh of Citizens Action Network in Rome, Georgia. After this interview, I did some more research into the Atlanta lawyer working for both the EPD on water issues and representing GE on the Rome PCB issue. This lawyer was mentioned in the interview with Jessica Lindbergh. I found this lawyer is from none other than King and Spalding, also mentioned in the interview, and, of course, Sam Nunn's law firm. The name of the lawyer in question is Patricia Barmeyer, and before joining King & Spalding, she worked as the Assistant Attorney General for the very same state of Georgia. Ms. Barmeyer of King & Spalding does indeed represent GE in fighting the EPD and EPA decisions about the Rome, Georgia situation. And yes, she also works as a key advisor to the state of Georgia's EPD on critical water issues for the state. Oh yes, and King & Spalding also represented GE in squashing two class action lawsuits against them for the dumping of PCBs in Rome, Georgia. So I stand corrected in what I said in the interview. It's not an old boys network after all. There's some old girls in it too. We're going to end this edition of Wizards by talking about science, the well-capitalized way. With all these environmental problems, GE has entered the business of funding medical studies in a big way. Miraculously, even though there are numerous studies finding a link between PCBs and serious health problems in animals, all the GE-funded medical studies find that humans and PCBs get along just fabulously. Let's hear some of Jack's medical words of wisdom.
Why doesn't a rational mind come to the conclusion that the risk is practically lower than breathing? Never mind that eating fish from the river has been banned for 2 decades, or that PCB levels in the water and fish have fallen 90% since 1977. More than 20 studies, most completely independent of GE, show no link between PCBs and cancer. At the end of the day, what happens in rats does not happen in humans when both are exposed to PCB.
In response, let's hear some more from Jessica Lindbergh about the scientific studies in a world of scarce financial capital.
Actually, just so that people have an idea of geographic relationships, how far is Rome from Anniston, Alabama?
2 hours, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know.
it's not that far. It's
no.
Maybe 100 miles
right,
or so.
Right, right, right.
And obviously the people of Anniston have brought these lawsuits against
right.
Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
Why have you not yet brought any kind of class action lawsuit? Is it the whole evidence thing?
It's the evidence.
The problem for you is not having access to the financial capital to perform the studies that
that
need to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the health studies? There's a doctor in Emory University who's worked a lot with you, and I know there's this blood testing that's going on of the people here. Can you talk about that?
Dr. Frumkin worked with Citizens Action Network and several other leaders of the community to put together what we thought was just a really great way to study the PCB numbers in the community,
mm-hmm.
and gave it to the health department, and the health department has been trying to seek funding for it for probably about 6 months now.
And then in terms of studying cancer, I mean, I guess there's no studies of the particular types of cancer or the particular areas that you've been talking about that are affected to either prove or disprove, you know.
That's been the problem all along, is lack of information both from a health perspective and from an environmental perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the money to fund to find out the information to get the answers we want, and GE has all the money in the world to keep it from happening.
To perform studies as well, that
right,
they
right.
that's right, miraculous.
To take the questions results. That we want answered and find their own answer and say, you don't even have to do this study because we've already answered the question.
Right. What do you see as the future of this problem? Where do you see it going?
I can't say that I have a lot of optimism for it. I think it's going to continue the way it's been going. I think it's going to continue for another 25 years and we might have one landfill cleaned up. But that it's going to be a long, long, slow process unless more information suddenly appears that could give us some answers.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
So, while government bodies can somehow find taxpayers' contributions available for hundreds of millions in what we called expropriation compensation, no government body can find the resources for a health study desired by the taxpayers. Never mind. After all, in Jack's words, it's just a game. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 9. Please note that the Wizards of Money has a website where you can get the text of all episodes of Wizards and find more information. The website is located at www.wizardsofmoney.org.
That's how we laugh a day away in the middle.